From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We've done a lot of shows over the years about how globalization took away jobs and the pharmaceutical industry took lives when it pushed opioids on the American people. Throw in the decline of unions and a dysfunctional Congress, and the result has been the collapse of working-class communities across this country. Well, journalist Nick Kristof, he grew up in Yamhill, Oregon, population about 1,000. He left to roam the world as a reporter, and while he was away, his town, his classmates and childhood buddies fell victim to the very scourges we talked about. A quarter of his high school class died prematurely. So he and his co-author and wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, write about what happened to Kristof's classmates with care and compassion in their new book. And Yamhill, with its despair but also its hope, is the story of this nation. So this hour on Point, Americans on the tightrope. And you can join us after you hear the story that Nick and Cheryl have to tell about Yamhill, Oregon. Do you think it's the story of your town or changes in your family? And what can we do as a nation to truly help each other cross that tightrope? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Cheryl Wu Dunn and Nicholas Kristof join me today from New York. In 1990, they became the first married couple to receive a Pulitzer Prize for journalism for their reporting on the Tiananmen Square protests. Today, Cheryl Wu Dunn is a business executive, and Nick Kristof is the columnist, or a columnist, for the New York Times. They still write as a team, and their fifth book, out just today, is called Tightrope: Americans Reaching for Hope. Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
Yes, thanks for having us, Meghna.
It's really great to have you both. I was wondering if you could just start by taking us back to what those school bus rides were like, Nick, growing up, the number 6 bus that you would take to and from school every day in Yamhill.
Sure. So our family farm was 4 miles from the town of Yamhill. And so every morning I'd trudge down the hill to get on the number 6 bus. And this was an area that was dependent on agriculture, timber, and light manufacturing. The biggest employer was a glove factory. And it was an area that had prospered enormously over the last 50 years or so. The Homestead Act, rural electrification, the GI Bill of Rights had really transformed it. Families were living much, much better than before. And so one of the families that got on right after me, there were 5 kids in it. And the eldest was my grade, Farlan, Farlan Knapp, and that he had 4 younger brothers and sisters and, you know, and lots of other kids getting on. And then we were all kind of full of hope, and we sort of assumed things were going, we were going to continue to thrive. And they didn't. And that's what led us to write the book. And, you know, Farlan and his friend, so Farlan died after a lot of drug and alcohol abuse. His brother Zeelan died, passed out, drunk during a house fire. His sister Rogina died after hepatitis C from drug use. Nathan blew himself up making meth. And the only one who survived was the youngest, Keelan, who survived partly because he was in the Oregon State Penitentiary for 13 years. And it's just – and that – you know, they were only one of 2 different families of 5 kids on the number 6 bus. Both, in both cases, 4 of the 5 are now gone. And it is just, you know, we were so naive. We thought everything was going to get better, and it sure didn't.
Okay. So there's so much to dig into here in the detail with which you write these stories. But Cheryl, let me just turn to you for a second. And most of the time, I'm just going to throw out questions, and Nick, you and Cheryl decide who's going to take them,
because sure,
you
no
are
problem.
A writing team here.
But
Cheryl, I did want to actually specifically ask you, since you didn't grow up in Yamhill, but you have been connected to it through Nick, and the two of you still are very very connected to the community, right? Because the farm is still there. I'm just wondering what you saw as you got to know this community that made you think that it has it had a bigger story to tell.
Well, we had been reporters in Asia in the developing world in China. And we also then were posted in Japan and covered, you know, elements of the developing world there as well. And so we had been used to writing about a variety of things, economic development and humanitarian crises. And we would come back every year. We'd go to Yemen. We'd spend a lot of time there. I got to know most of his friends, and one of his friends, one in the family, the Green family, worked on Nick's parents' farm. He was a farmhand there, a very, very capable man there. And so we watched how his life, at least in the time that we saw him, changed. But as we kept coming back to Yamhill, we saw that, my goodness, we've been covering humanitarian crises around the world, and we come back to Yamhill and we see that there is one unfolding in our own backyard. Mm. And it was pretty shocking for us to realize this. And it took us a little bit of digging because, you know, you see them, they put a smile on their face, but it's when you start asking about what's going on, you know, in their home lives, what's going on at home, what's happening with their kids. That's when things begin to unravel and you realize that the type of pain and suffering that people in the developing world, when we write about poverty there, are suffering, it's happening here in the U.S. because it is ultimately about the human condition.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the naps more, right? So what was the thing or things that underlies the tragedies that happened to so many members of the Knapp family?
So I think it was jobs. And, you know, I look back and Yamhill is basically Lily White. And in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of invidious comments made about the struggles in the black community at the time and a lot of discussion in Yamhill about, oh, how this was all because of quote-unquote black culture and, you know, people blaming what they call deadbeat dads and family breakdown and people would just pull themselves up by the bootstraps, everything would be okay. And meanwhile, the great Harvard sociologist William Julius Wilson was arguing that basically the problems were because of lost jobs. And, you know, he was exactly right, and that became true of white communities like Yamhill as well. And so Farland's dad had a good job for a while, a good union job laying pipe, and his mom worked as a tractor driver at a big hazelnut farm. And so the parents, even though they didn't have a lot of education, they had good jobs. They were able to buy their first family home. When Farland turned 16, he got a gift from his parents of a Ford Mustang, and we were all incredibly jealous. And so it was possible then for, you know, a blue-collar family to really live a pretty decent life and rise up. And then Farland, Zeeland, Nathan, Regina, and Keelan could not replicate that. None of them graduated from high school. And without a high school or even more, you know, a college degree, they struggled to find work. And Farland's problems accelerated after he was laid off after 20 years at the same company nearby. And there were a lot of self-esteem issues, and I think they – there was a tendency to self-medicate with meth or alcohol or opioids.
Was there self-blame too?
Yeah. You know, this is an area that had, I think, very much absorbed the narrative the pioneer narrative. You know, we maybe particularly as Oregonians, we talked about our ancestors who'd taken the Oregon Trail and it was all about individualism and being rugged and solving problems. And you know, what I now realize is that those people who took the Oregon Trail, yeah, there was tremendous rugged individualism, but they were responding to a government benefit program. They knew that if they got to the Willamette Valley, they would get 640 acres to homestead. And so it was interaction of great initiative, but also a government program. Mm-hmm. But I think we overabsorbed that narrative about personal responsibility. And so when people struggled and could not do as well as their parents had, then perhaps especially men tended to blame themselves and two, self-medicate, which got them criminal records, which made them less employable and less marriageable. Mm. And it just started this cycle downward.
You know, you're talking to a fellow Oregonian, Nick.
Megan, where are you from in Oregon?
I actually grew up 50 miles south of you in Corvallis, Oregon.
I
was thinking about the differences that even just a little bit of geography and certain internal economic structures can make, right? Because Corvallis is like, I just double checked on the map, it's literally 50 miles due south of Yamhill.
Yeah.
But a larger town, it was like, when I was growing up, it was like 45, 50,000 people. So bigger, first and foremost.
And a university town.
It has a university. It has Oregon State University. And also, when I was growing up, it had Hewlett-Packard, a huge manufacturing plant for Hewlett-Packard.
Right.
So there were these two big anchors of like two big economic engines for the town of Corvallis, which really has long sort of – it's had its ups and downs, but it's mostly insulated it from the big changes that are happening – that happen all around in the communities around me when I was growing up, the logging communities you mentioned, the farming communities in the Willamette Valley and the Cascade Range. So I just bring that up because it's like this next door example of the importance of the jobs, the very jobs that you're talking about, and how when in some communities they don't go away because they have these institutions, but in others when they do go away, what is there to replace it?
That's right. And Megan, I think I think in America we tend to think of geography in terms of, you know, the West versus the East versus the South and so on. But in many ways, the economic geography has been much closer than that. And, you know, Portland has thrived, Yamhill has suffered, and there are Yamhills all over the country.
Well, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu-Dunn join us today. They are co-authors of the new book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. It begins with the story of what happened to many of Nick Kristof's classmates from his high school in Yamhill, Oregon. But really, it's the story of a nation. We'll explore more of that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Cheryl Wu-Dunn and Nicholas Kristof. They are the co-authors of the new book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. And Nick and Cheryl, I was wondering if you could tell us more about Farlan Knapp specifically, because sort of a little bit more of his life story and then how sort of the economic cratering of his life has also carried on in subsequent generations.
Sure. So Farlan was a really talented woodworker. He had some ambitions of having a furniture store that he was going to call something like Farlan's Fantastic Freaky Furniture, or some name like that. I think the reason he dropped out of school was partly because in the previous generation, it didn't really seem to matter so much whether you graduated from high school, that you could still get good jobs, good union jobs, even if you didn't have a high school diploma. And then initially he did get decent jobs and it seemed to work. He married. He had two daughters. They adored him. He loved them. And, you know, in many ways, he was a great dad. I must say one of the daughters told us that in one of her baby pictures, there's a little plate of cocaine. So it was not, you know, maybe not in every way an optimal childhood for them. But he really tried hard. After he died, one of the daughters, Andrea, accelerated her own drinking, and she died soon after at age 29. The other daughter, Amber, had avoided drugs until then, but she started with anti-anxiety medication, and then she turned to meth as well. And she, Amber, is so talented and smart. She reminds me of Farlan, and she was working in a corporate job doing IT work, but then the meth just took over, and she lost the job. She lost her kids, and when we were finishing up with the book, we were texting with her to try to get more photos of Farlan. And then one day she stopped responding to our texts, and finally her daughter responded for her and said, "Mom's back in jail."
Hmm. Now, Cheryl, I mean, the story about Farlan and his daughters, the reason why I ask is because it's a perfect example of how it's not just jobs we're talking about, right? If these tragedies and challenges are carrying on from generation to generation, there's something more systemic, right, that we have to be facing.
There is. There's a lot more to – I mean, jobs is a huge trigger, and it does mean more than just income. It means an identity. So it is very important when people get laid off. It affects not only themselves but also their families. And particularly in the U.S., obviously healthcare is an important difference. We actually compared – if you look across the country, we compared what happened when auto workers were laid off after the financial crisis in both Detroit and in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. And what happened was that in the U.S., they extended unemployment benefits because of the unusual circumstances of the financial crisis. And so people had cash, but they also didn't have a job, they didn't have health care, and they had a lot of difficulty coping. In Ontario, they did lose their jobs, but of course, Canada has a national health care system, so they didn't lose their health care benefits. And also, Canada immediately, they have these things called activity centers, and they kicked in and looked around the area for local corporations who could employ people. They found that nursing was in demand, so they created a program to retrain these auto workers to become nursing experts, or at least develop some nursing skills. And they were replaced, and so you find out that months later, years later, these workers are back in society. They are not as entangled in drugs and alcoholism and depression as was the case in the U.S.
Mm. Well, so this is why you talk about that we have to reckon with social responsibility as well as personal responsibility, right?
Yes. The narrative shouldn't just be about personal responsibility. I mean, obviously, one still has to have some of that, but also about social responsibility and policymaking at the top level, down to the local level. We don't focus as much on how the rules are made in a way that really does not favor the poor, the people who are less educated, and that really they don't have voices, and so they don't have lobbyists, and so their interests are not looked after.
Mm. Magna, can I rant about this a little bit?
You can rant a lot about it if you want.
So this is one of the things that we found really frustrating. That, you know, look, there are better policies, and we know how to come up with them. A lot of them are evidence based, but it seems to me the big impediment is often the narrative that we have in this country, and a lot of that narrative is about personal responsibility, about how it's all about one's own initiative, about pulling oneself up by the bootstraps. And I mean that so from conservatives, that's a narrative. From liberals, people tend to – there's sometimes a tendency to blame those struggling in the white working class for electing Republicans and bringing problems upon themselves as a result, as sort of they made their bed, now let them lie in it. And this just seems to me so lacking in empathy on both sides. And when you can predict that a baby is going to have worse outcomes, is going to be less likely to graduate from high school or to go to college or to even live a long life, when you have a 15-year gap between the poor and the rich in America, a 15-year gap in life expectancy, then that's not because of bad choices that some infant is making, either in terms of drug use or in terms of the candidates they're voting for. It's because of structures that we as a country have put in place. And I think unless we change this narrative and show a little more empathy for those left behind, we're not going to get around to policies that can help. It's got to be less about pointing fingers and more about offering helping hands.
But it's also explicitly about policymaking. I mean, when you can buy a $238 million condo in the heart of New York City prime real estate, when a hedge fund mogul can do that and yet pay property taxes that are equivalent to a condo worth $9.4 million, that is a huge subsidy to that hedge fund mogul, whereas we actually complain that now even people who are on food stamps have to have work requirements. It just makes no sense.
Mm. I suppose this is a time that I do have to ask, I mean, because we're talking about the stories and the experiences and the lessons to be learned from the very people that you went to school with and grew up with, Nick. Why do you think your life didn't follow that path?
So, look, I mean, there were plenty of people in Yamhill who thrived. And if you look at the National Honor Society photo in my yearbook, those kids are all doing great. I guess my best friend still in Yamhill is the local dairyman who's, you know, built up a wonderful dairy. He's converted it to organic. He's done great. And so I think a lot of it was about not how much money you had, but how much social capital and how much human capital the families had. And so, look, I grew up in a house that was full of books. My parents read to me every moment. And Farlan, I don't know that there was a single children's book in the house. And so I think so much of it was about the environments that the family environments we grew up in, and how much respect there was for education, how important education was, and how much focus there was on, I mean, you know, our metrics for poverty are based on income, but better metrics for long-term outcomes might be how often kids are hugged or how often they're read to.
Interest. So, I take both your points about how policy really, really does matter, and at the same time, this is not a but, this is an and. And we're also talking about, I mean, Nick, you just gave us the example about how like the individual human capital within a family also matters. Is there a way to bring the two together?
Absolutely.
I think education is extremely important. We actually do neglect early childhood education when a lot of these problems are much easier to solve and at a much lower cost. So, for instance, when you talk about, as Nick mentioned, infants born in a certain zip code where we can predict that they're going to have a terrible outcome, it's really important to catch that baby when he or she is very young, because if they've got drugs in their system when they're born, you need to really do a lot of change work that matters. And you can. I was visiting a preschool, Circle Preschool in Virginia, run by Kathy Ryan. And she basically took a little baby named Jay, who had drugs born in his system, was, you know, a troubled kid, always angry, fighting, wailing constantly. And within 4 months, she was able to turn him around. And when I saw him, he looked like just this happy kid who was playing and laughing and hugging. And so you can replicate that across the country. And we do need to do that, because if you have a kid who is born with what they call adverse childhood experiences, three or four of them within a childhood, that doesn't only mean that they will, you know, maybe they probably won't graduate from high school. It also means that physically, health-wise, they will end up more likely with diabetes, with heart disease, with all sorts of issues related to their health.
Well, let's go to a call here. We are talking this hour with Cheryl Wudunn and Nicholas Kristof. They are co-authors of the new book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I sort of caught towards the end of your guest's comment on how there's this sort of resentment towards Republicans for so to speak, making their bed and having to lie in it for voting for Republicans and by extension Republican policies. And so my immediate thought to that, and maybe I need to let it simmer a bit more, is And maybe I'm not, maybe I'm just not a very empathetic person, but perhaps they do need to realize that the bed they've made is the one they're going to lie in that if you're going to vote for socially conservative policies, by extension, by voting for Republicans, you're also inadvertently putting yourself in a bad place economically. If your goal is to hopefully vote for people who are going to make policies that help you, you can't at the same time vote for the same people that are going to force your moral views, religious views on the public. And so I think social conservatism in America has vastly damaged economic conservatism, or not so much damaged, but almost married it, really.
Well, Alex, let me just jump in here because I'm going to give Cheryl and Nick a chance to respond. But let me just ask you, take your point, but one of the greatest champions of so-called welfare reform was a Democratic president. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that. Sorry, say that again.
You're saying that. That you see if people have voted for Republican members of Congress, for example, they've then paved the way for these conservative policies to be put into place. And I'm saying that in addition to that, we went through a Democratic presidency with President Bill Clinton, where his administration made a lot of changes too regarding mass incarceration, regarding the welfare reform, that it's not exclusively a Republican thing.
Oh, certainly not. But I think, I mean, at least in the last, probably about the last decade, I'm trying to think what year it is now. In the last decade, I think you've seen a great divide between the Republican Party being the quote-unquote conservative party and the Democratic Party not even being so, like, the so-called liberal party. I mean, it's like the socialist party now. Bernie Sanders, to some extent, Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Mm-hmm. Like, these new Democrats are paving the way for young people to champion these social programs.
Yeah. Well, Alex, I really appreciate your call a lot, and I want to give Cheryl and Nick a chance to respond. So, Alex, thank you. Cheryl, Nick, what do you think?
I think that it is true that sometimes people vote against their own self-interests. I think actually, all sorts of Democrats do that too. I mean, a lot of people vote against their own self-interest. I think it also takes a while for people to recognize that something that a person they're voting for isn't actually helping them, but it in fact is hurting them, and they're willing to give people sort of a break. For instance, the soybean farmers, they're willing to give President Trump a break because they think that for the long term he's doing something right. So it only goes so far. I mean, maybe 10 years is the right horizon for certain types of policies. The other thing is that people also sometimes vote on one particular thing. So if you are really care about having your own guns and having the freedom to walk around with your guns, you're not going to vote for a Democrat, no matter what the rest of the agenda is. And as long as the economy is doing very well, at least for the majority of Americans or for a plurality of Americans, it's going to cover up a lot of things. It is, unfortunately, for the voiceless group of people in America, the economy isn't working, still isn't working.
Mm. The problem that I have with the argument that people have made their bed and now let them lie in it is that some of these are infants we're talking about. You know, a newborn infant in Shannon County, South Dakota, has a life expectancy shorter than if that infant were born in Cambodia or Bangladesh. And that infant has not elected – doesn't have the right to vote, hasn't chosen anybody, hasn't supported any policies. And so even if you believe that is true of adults, it is children who are paying the price. And so I think we need a little more empathy all around.
Well, so now, though, that there seems to be a lot more conversation across the country and the grappling with the fallout from 40 years of policies, 50 years of policies that have acted in opposition to the well-being of so many millions of Americans. I mean, now can't we say to voters today, look at your children, your potential grandchildren, the vote you cast is the future bed that people are going to lie in. Can't we say that to people now?
We can, and I wish that Democrats were a little better at talking to working class Americans. You know, Bobby Kennedy was magnificent at it. More recently, Democratic politicians have sometimes struggled. They sometimes come across as condescending.
Well, we're going to come right back in about a minute and a half and talk about where there's room for hope in this story. So Cheryl Wudunn and Nicholas Kristof stand by. Their new book is Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Cheryl Wudunn and Nicholas Kristof about their new book. It's called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. And it begins with the story of what has happened to many of Nick Kristof's classmates in the town, the small town of Yamhill, Oregon, where Nick grew up, and the story that the bottoming out of their lives has to tell about the struggles of working-class Americans across the country. And Nick and Cheryl, if I may, I'd like to bring into the conversation now Diane Reynolds. She joins us from Dayton, Oregon. She's lived in Yamhill County since 1977. She's an ordained pastor and founder of the nonprofit called Provoking Hope, and she's profiled in Cheryl and Nick's book. Diane Reynolds, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
It's really wonderful to have you. And your story is quite powerful, Diane. So before we get to what you do at Provoking Hope, I was wondering if you'd be willing to tell us a little bit about sort of your life growing up in Yamhill County. You didn't have it easy, did you?
I did not have an easy life, and the subjects and things that Cheryl and Nick have shared prior to me coming on here would pretty much relate to my life experiences. And I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana, just to correct that.
Oh, okay.
So my mother and my father, my parents were both alcoholics, and my mom, I didn't know this as a child, but she was also a drug user, and my dad was absent from the time I was three until way late in my life, and so I had myself, I'm the oldest, and there are three siblings who came along through the course of growing up, and essentially it was me and them.
You had to take care of them.
Yes, yes. So my mom worked in a bar, and you know, and she lived a hard life. And I now understand, as a grown up and having done a lot of you know, processing and intentional thinking into my own childhood, I recognize and realize that she was a product of her home, mm-hmm. and her environment, and she did the best she could, very much like what Nick was saying about Farland. You know, there were those moments, but then there were also these other moments when she was under the influence and she would allow things that were harmful, mm-hmm. not only for me, but for my other siblings.
Yeah. I mean, you had to endure some pretty awful abuse, to put it lightly.
Yes.
But Diane, if I may ask you, you became an ordained minister, worked really hard, and now ministering to a group of people. Can you tell us a story about how it is you came about founding Provoking Hope? Because insofar as what Cheryl and Nick write, it just sounds like you got fed up with having to lay to rest so many young people who had experienced something very similar to what you had growing up.
Correct. So it was like the beginning of the summer of 2011, and I had been in attendance at yet another memorial service for a young man who had lost his life to his addiction, you know, holding on and hugging his parents, his wife, his babies, and I just started crying. I had to get out of there. It was something like number 11 for that year for me, and I just was so angry, and the thing that came to my mind was Popeye, when he pops the lid off the spinach can, you know, the old Popeye cartoon. Mm-hmm. And I've done all as I can, and I can't do no more. I can't do this anymore. I can't just be the burying person. And I have to be a part of the solution, or I have to get completely out of this. I can't do this. And the rest of it is just, it's like I looked to the right. There was a for rent sign. I called the number. I called my husband. He met me. We walked through this little tiny dark basement office, agreed to rent it. I didn't have any great grandiose plan. I wanted to be a part of the solution.
Yeah. And the next day, right, Provoking Hope opens its doors.
Yes.
Cheryl and Nick, what is it that Diane's doing at Provoking Hope that you see as part of the solution set that America needs?
One of the critical things that Diane does is that she has peer counselors who help each other, and they have street credibility, which is really important. And obviously, Diane has credibility herself as well. There's no judgment passed. I mean, this is, you want to get better. We're going to help you. We're going to talk about it. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? We sat in on some of the sessions, and it's very freewheeling. All the people there, most of them are in varying degrees of wanting to get better. And we saw how in one case, the person who really wanted to get better was just, encouraging and rooting for all the others in the class. And so it's very powerful. And the other thing that Diane does, which is really remarkable, is that she trusts people. One of the things, and she could probably tell you this better, but Diane, I remember you telling us how, you go to a newcomer and you say, here are the car keys and here is my credit card. I need you to go down and buy some milk from the local store. And they look at her and they're like, wait, I was just in and out of jail and for stealing, and you're giving me your credit card and your car keys.
Wow.
But it's about trust.
Right.
And Diane, Provoking Hope serves what, about 7,800 people now each year, just under 8,000, if I'm remembering from the book correctly?
Correct. That would have been the total for that year. It's risen. I would say 2019, our number's going to be closer to about 950 or close to 1,000.
Uh-huh. So you're making a real difference in individual lives there in Yamhill County, and a lot of them. But Diane, I'm curious. At the very beginning of this conversation, Nick and Cheryl were talking about how there are also these like big systemic and policy issues across the country. I mean, is there a limit to how much Provoking Hope can do to transform people's lives if we don't yet have those policy solutions in place also?
I totally believe that the policies have to be, we have to change, and it starts at policy. We need people to begin who are serving our nation to begin to be real about what's going on in America. The latest statistics for our state are astounding. We are 48 in drug-related problems across the United States, and we're 45th at the help that's provided. Seven Oregonians a day lose their lives to this systemic ignorance, I call it, you know, blindsidedness. The people who are making the decisions are not looking at those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
At my level, I'm looking at those numbers. The week between Christmas and New Year's, we had two telephone calls into 911 overdose, and one day it was three in the same day. This is the reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or a Libertarian, it really doesn't matter. What matters is there's a solution, and lives can be transformed. Families can be reunified. There is hope.
Yeah.
If we could, in those hallways, if we could figure out how to get the help out onto the streets that's needed,
yeah,
through a change in policies.
Well, Diane Reynolds, joining us from Dayton, Oregon, an ordained pastor and founder of the nonprofit Provoking Hope. Diane, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Nick and Cheryl, we've got about 6 minutes left here, and I want to just be sure to at least get one, if not two more callers before we run out of too much time here. So let's go to Herman, who's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Herman, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to comment on the fact that the gentleman in the beginning of the program, he touched on the fact that it's a contrast as black and white, as just as well as the users, as with the opioid and mm-hmm. the cocaine epidemic, as how the response is, and so now it's not like opioid, it's not as criminalized. There's always treatments and things available to help the people and the children of the epidemic. It's realized, like the crack epidemic, I'm a victim of that epidemic of the crack that was put into the community. And just based on my zip code where I was born in Cabrini Greens, it made it almost inevitable that I would have certain effects in my life from the cocaine and the heroin that was in those areas. Into today, I still suffer from those effects in multiple ways. It's because we're at points in times where I was supposed to get certain checks and growth and development, mm-hmm. they weren't there because the drugs had consumed
yeah.
all the emotion in the community. It consumed all the hope, you know.
Yeah.
The only thing we had was God. You know, that's all we had was Christ, and so in the hope, and
right.
so you know, but
Herman, if I may, forgive me for interrupting you here, but you bring up a point that I definitely want to hear more from Nick and Cheryl on. So Herman, thank you for your call. I mean, Nick, you had talked about William Julius Wilson earlier. I guess the follow up question I have from Herman's personal story here is: the nation has been through this before,
it has.
And we know exactly what happens to communities that we don't help, that we abandon. I mean, he was talking about growing up in Cabrini
right.
Green. So certainly
right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there is no doubt that there is a double standard and a real element of hypocrisy, and that now, you know, we used to talk about as a country, we used to talk about junkies, and now we talk about people who need treatment for addiction. And there's certainly much more compassion now that many more of those struggling are white. And, you know, is that hypocritical? Absolutely. But it is also at least belatedly a welcome improvement in policy. But, you know, on the drug side, you sort of still see that. And in Tightrope, we talked to a woman who had an addiction and was sent to prison in Alabama for 999 years for nonviolent drug offenses. And meanwhile, a African American woman who had a long history of using drugs. And meanwhile, the Sackler family was far more responsible for opioid addiction in America, and obviously not only did not face criminal sanctions, but has emerged with $13 billion.
Mm.
Talk about double standards.
Yeah. So we've got about 2.5 minutes left here, and there's a couple of things. I want to try and tie a couple of things together in the conversation we've been having for the past hour. I mean, one of them is, in hearing Diane's story about what she's doing at Provoking Hope in Yamhill right now, obviously making a huge difference in the lives of a lot of people. But it's still a really local response because that's as far as Diane can reach. And you do talk about other places where people are finding hope. It's local. Now, but I'm still hearing from both of you that we need something from the federal government to really change the picture for everybody, don't we?
We need a mix, and basically you do need to have community innovation, and you have to have community investment and personal resources investment. They have to want to do this. At the same time, you need federal level, national level government support because they can't do it on their own. And it has to be scalable. So, for instance, the preschool, in Virginia, they can build a template. They're trying to build a template right now. And so that it can be, the methodology can be replicated throughout the country. Provoking Hope can also start building a template so that it can be replicated throughout the country. But there needs to be government at the federal level, some support system and some guidance so that communities can actually come onto the platform.
Yeah, Meghna, I mean, it would be crazy to think that America would try to build an interstate highway system with little tiny organizations around the country like Provoking Hope. And likewise, I mean, they're wonderful, and Diane is a hero, but it's likewise crazy to try to address these excruciating gaps we as a country have simply with tiny organizations led by heroes around the country. We need more.
So what is stopping this country from doing that right now? What's crazy is the thought that we can't get this done.
I think there's a lot of dysfunction, of course, in Washington, D.C., but there are some places that one can actually build common ground between the left and the right, and that is around childhood education. In fact, red states have done early childhood education, very, very well. And if we can use those as role models and just basically replicate them across the country, I think that's a beginning.
And the problems have often been invisible, and so thank you for helping remove that invisibility.
Well, thank you to the both of you for writing this book. The new book is Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, co-authored by Cheryl Wu Dunn and Nicholas Kristof. We have an excerpt, by the way, of it at onpointradio.org. Cheryl and Nick, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Meghna.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.